I'm Danny. Danny Schechter.
Known as the News Dissector.
You know, I joined the media. Preserving democracy. Do something about the problems of the world. I'm the author. I'm the producer.
Hey, hello, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
Issues. The history of the world.
Hey, hello, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
That's me, that's what I think.
Hey, where did it play?
Demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted. The media. Issues. That's me, that's what I think. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, what do you think?
Well, somebody mapped my brain using advanced medical techniques and came up with that particular introduction. Hello, everybody. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here with Paul R. Levine at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We are moving to the end of the year. This will be the last program of the year, I believe. We're not going to be here the day after Christmas. Christmas is coming. There's very few shopping days left, people. So stay out of the stores if you possibly can, because you're not going to like it in those stores. The big sales are always after Christmas, aren't they? So I don't know why the hunger, the haste. Can't you just give people a photo of what you're going to give them as a gift and say it'll get here when it gets here? Anyway.
Well, that sounds like an idea. You send a photo and, you know, yes, no, and if they don't like it, then buy something yourself.
There you go. Anyway, we are going to be talking a little bit about this whole ongoing, continuing, never-ending spy surveillance scandal, which is not only, you know, freaking out many of our allies, but also our adversaries, also the American people. And something big is happening because suddenly there's a reform proposal on the agenda. Yet there's also other aspects of this, the complicity of many of the telecom and electronic giants who are in bed with the U.S. government. Here to tell us about that is Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is, what is this guy? He's a media critic. He's a writer. He could have been a congressman. Maybe he will be a congressman. He's in California. He's somebody I've known for many years and respected for many years before I got to know him because of the clarity of his writing and the thoughtfulness of his insights into what's happening in our political system. He's also an activist and part of the Roots movement, which he'll tell us more about. So, Norman, stay there. Get ready. We're about to come to you in a minute. But first, this musical message.
Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you because you really listen. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. I can't even get through to my mama. But you listen so well to the secrets I tell. Guess that's how Obama caught Osama. NSA, listen please while I order extra cheese. I love you because you really listen.
That's Roy Zimmerman doing a fantastic Elvis impersonation, having rewritten lyrics to one of his songs. That's called Hello, NSA.
Well, you know, once all these institutions become part of the popular culture, it's not long before they become the target of incredible satire. Right now, there's an incredible anger. But as all of us who remember the movie Dr. Strangelove know, sometimes by satirizing some of these maniacs, you actually render them less influential. Joining me from his estate somewhere in California is Norman Solomon. Norman, are you there?
I am. Hi, Danny.
Hi. Glad you could be with us. We wanted to talk a little bit about your latest, you know, kind of, you know, point of criticism involving the person who just bought the Washington Post. Tell us about what you discovered in researching this.
Yes, I think it's the beginning of an upsurge of challenge to the Washington Post, which is the dominant newspaper of political daily coverage in the United States. It is so ubiquitous in the nation's capital. It has so much political capital, you might say. And one of the very underreported realities is that Jeff Bezos, the founder and major owner of Amazon, who has tens of billions, with a B, dollars of personal wealth, not only purchased the Washington Post and is now the only owner of the Post as of about 4 months ago, but his company, Amazon, recently concluded a $600 million 10-year contractual deal with the Central Intelligence Agency. So we have a situation now where this very powerful newspaper is reporting on the CIA on a regular basis and not informing in those articles, the readers of those articles, that the sole owner of the newspaper is in this huge business deal with the CIA.
What is the business deal? What are they doing?
Well, yes, it was concluded this fall, and Amazon is providing very complicated, in-depth, private cloud services, as they call it, up in the computer cloud, that will provide the CIA with all sorts of computing, memory, storage, and security capacities for its intelligence networks and all the data thereof. And you can imagine when your job as a CIA is to snoop into the activities of the world, theoretically not including in the United States, but gathering so-called intelligence, and what was it? George Carlin had a list of oxymorons like jumbo shrimp and military intelligence. But anyway, intelligence is the CIA's middle name. And the access to Amazon services through the cloud is really hugely important for the CIA. It's financially important for the Amazon company. And that company announced this fall that it is, in its own words, looking forward to a successful relationship with the CIA. And, Danny, I think we can assume that this is just the beginning of their dance together.
Could it have something to do with maybe they had advanced knowledge of these Obamacare websites not working and decided instead of trying to build their own cloud capacity, they would go with somebody who actually is in business and has to keep some sort of systems in place and made this deal?
Yes, you know, it is a matter of, as we see time and again in many contexts, it's a matter of priorities. When you want to deliver the tanks and the troops and the bombers, you spare no expense. You get it right. But when it comes to, providing health care to people, well, you know, we'll let it slide because we can't really pay top dollar for quality.
Well, fortunately, Amazon doesn't have access to people's personal information.
Not true.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other wrinkle. And when the curtain lifts and the dawn light bulb goes on, including in my head, more and more, I realize this is just the beginning. It is staggering to think about Amazon being in the middle of this nexus, including the Washington Post, I would guess, into the hundreds of millions of people now whose personal data is part of the Amazon sales database. And lest we forget the recently floated scenario for domestic drones for product delivery by Amazon in the United States.
Yeah, I can't wait for that to happen. But here's the thing, you know, these companies, all of them, talk about, you know, their terms of service. We all get these incredibly illegible and difficult to understand, even if you want to try to, which most people don't understand, agreements. And you click agree so you can get access to whatever product you want or service you need. But in many cases, there's an implied guarantee or a statement by these companies that they are defending or protecting your privacy, which is a relationship between the company and the customer. And they're very, you know, customer friendly, customer attentive, customer responsible, and all the rest of that, until they aren't, until they're quite prepared to sell your data to the highest bidder or to whatever government agency. I'm sure that if the KGB, ex-KGB, a current whatever it's called, the FSB, wants the data and they can pay more than the CIA, they might make a deal with them too. I mean, this is a situation where countries have very little to do with it. It's just business. And business in this case, you know, I had a problem, Norman. I don't know how you would have handled this, but, you know, I read in the paper that AT&T, which is my telecom provider, had not only been providing the NSA with unknown and undisclosed data from their customer base, presumably me being part of that, but they were being paid by the NSA for the time that it took them, you know, to be able to accommodate the NSA's many requests, which were, you know, way up there in terms of tens of thousands of requests for more information about Joe or Harry or Jane or whoever. So I wrote to AT&T and I said, you know, aren't you supposed to be involved with my protecting my privacy? What exactly are you doing with this company, and why are you doing it, and when will you stop doing it? You know, it's basically the questions I posed to them. Well, I got back a response from some maven who just said, you know, dear Mr. Schechter, we're happy to have you as a customer, but the questions you're raising involve national security, and hence we are not at liberty to discuss it, period, full stop, the end of discussion. So they're using this as a way to cover this relationship, which apparently is quite profitable for them, in addition to being quite compromising of the information of millions of people.
Yes, a very lucrative relationship. And as the message from AT&T to you seems to boil down to, none of your business, just pay your bill. It's really notable that just on December 16th of this year, just days ago, a federal judge ruled that this wholesale vacuuming up of billions of phone records probably, the judge said, unconstitutional, violation of the Fourth Amendment. You and I and many, many thousands of other activists were saying that from the get-go when the Snowden documents were revealed last June. And this intersection of corporate profiteering and government contracts is so enormous that it swallows up a lot of Silicon Valley. It is, you know, totally destructive of our civil liberties, including First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments. And I think it's going to be crucial that in the coming year we sustain the pushback against these Big Brother tactics. As a matter of fact, you know, when you go back and you skim through the book Big Brother, or the 1984 title of that book, and you read through it, it almost seems kind of quaint. I'm not saying I would want to live in George Orwell's 1984 world. Of course I would not, but frankly, while I love life, I'm not too crazy about being alive in this world, which has the kind of digital surveillance that Orwell, I don't think, even could have imagined.
Well, you know, the other aspect of all of this, first of all, read this judge's opinion. It's out there. You can Google it. You can Yahoo it, whatever you do, to get information. Because he's a very sarcastic judge. This is a judge appointed by George Bush. This is a judge who was like a big supporter of the Patriot Act, okay, and agreed to it, and then later revised some of his original rulings. And he seems to be somebody who is thinking more for himself. One of the people bringing the complaint against the NSA was, I guess, a libertarian conservative, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union. But this judge's ruling, you know, was hard to argue with, I found. You know, I mean, this guy, and of course, the New York Times characterized the judge as being very opinionated and somehow, you know, in conflict with the underlying statutes and law, you know, all that sort of legal niceties and what have you. But I was very impressed with this ruling, also the where it was coming from. It wasn't coming from, you know, some, you know, left-wing fanatic like me, you know. It was coming from this very reputable judge who is extremely well, it's very well considered, didn't you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's really the aggregate of a lot of assessments that a lot of people have made in the last half year that the media establishment has largely pushed back against. The efforts have been profuse to stigmatize and denounce Edward Snowden, and not just on Fox News. I've seen it on MSNBC. The loyalists for Obama have gone hammer and tong against Snowden.
Nasty.
And I think it's clear that the media establishment and indeed the Obama White House are back on their heels now about all this, as they should be.
Well, I think, you know, there are three things happening here. I just wrote about it in my blog at newsdissector.net this morning, okay? You know, basically the convergence of a kind of a trifecta of resistance. First, on the legal front, this judge's ruling, I think, gives permission to other judges who are probably even more stand-up judges for the First Amendment and for American freedom to actually not be afraid and not be intimidated about issuing similar or even stronger rulings. So that legal breakthrough, I think, was very important. The second is a tremendous amount of pushback. We don't know the extent of it. From consumers, from the people who have found out, you know, that Verizon or AT&T or Amazon or whoever is colluding with, you know, and compromising their freedom. And they're pissed about it. And they're writing letters like I did to this company. I'm sure they're getting tons of it. And now there was just this recent meeting at the White House with the president and the technology companies, 14 technology companies. And, you know, Obama was looking for help for his websites and trying to talk about these issues. And they wanted to talk about stop this program, reform these practices. So there's corporate pressure on Obama, and I think it's coming in response to consumer complaints. I believe that we're going to find some company is going to really take seriously protecting people's rights, and they're going to end up getting a lot of business as a result of it. You know, and you haven't seen this before where the companies who have been in bed with the government are suddenly criticizing the president to his face and issuing statements and making points about this. And that's a lot of power. So that's another aspect of all this. I think the third part of it is the global nature of it. The fact that the NSA has overreached so much in so many countries that there's, you know, other governments are pushing back, and maybe not as much as we'd like them to, many hypocritically, because some of them were, you know, trading data with the NSA, et cetera, and so forth. But, you know, Germany, our ally there, Brazil, and I'm sure many other countries are extremely uptight about this, and many countries have invested a lot of money into security protocols to try to prevent this happening, you know, spying that they don't want to happen to happen.
You know, the issue also, and this is something I think is vitally important, it provides, you know, one of those rare meeting points between the right and the left, the right of center, the left of center, the far right and the far left. If the fundamentalists on both sides could get over themselves a little bit, I mean, you have an issue that from the bottom up could turn out to be
well. Yeah, what do you
really
say about
powerful.
That, Norman? Because, you know, I see you not just as a individual critic or commentator, but as a strategist, as somebody who is making arguments for how progressives can have more influence and more clout. Isn't this an issue that's just waiting to do a tremendous mobilizing around? I mean, I haven't seen MoveOn doing it. I really don't see even Free Press doing it. It seems to me to be an issue that whoever steps into it with, you know, a well-conceived campaign could have a big impact.
Well, there are parallels between the anti-war, don't attack Syria upsurge that happened in late summer and the upsurge against NSA surveillance. And in both of those cases, as tracked by and reflected by the votes on the Amash Amendment this summer, which almost passed, would have been a real knockdown of the NSA surveillance, and the announced plans on votes, which didn't come to a vote about bombing Syria, in both cases, with very few exceptions, there was tremendous overlap. In other words, to flip it over, those who were defending NSA surveillance and pushing to bomb Syria included Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. That was the hierarchy of the Democratic and Republican parties defending a plan to make war on yet another country overtly and also to reinforce the surveillance policies of the NSA. And against that, you might say, establishment hierarchy position were self-described Republican libertarians, sometimes called Tea Party, and then some progressives in Congress, and they reflected their bases and their constituencies. And I think that that is all to the good on war issues and on civil liberties issues. A cautionary, though, at the same time, is that you can't build political coalitions across the board that then will enable you to, for instance, have an electoral alliance that will elect people. Because when we sit down, and by we I mean progressives, sit down with folks who are of the libertarian right, and we say, we have to stop NSA surveillance, yeah, we have agreement. When we say, we don't want to bomb yet another country, we have agreement. When they say, yes, and another thing we have as priority next year is to dismantle Medicare and Social Security, then that's when the coalition stops. So I would just sum up by saying, you know, for those who are trying to get to a majority in the House and Senate, you take your votes wherever you can. But that single issue alliances, it's not an across the board political realignment.
There are other ways. I mean, there's the search engine that I use is called DuckDuckGo, and and they claim that they don't take personal information. And you know, there's that option where
that would be horrifying, Pilar, for them to get personal information on you. I mean.
There's so
freak
much,
out, you know.
There.
Okay.
No, but you know, there are alternatives to Google. There's alternatives to Amazon, and if people, you know, on a huge, broad base across the political spectrum, can agree that, and this is the way all coalitions are made in all governments. We will agree on this issue. That we're going to, it has nothing to do with electoral politics. It has to do with educating people about alternatives.
Yeah, but ultimately what he's saying is, you know, we've got to change the composition of the Congress and, you know, or we're going to be forever in this sort of protest mode and never in a mode where we can really implement, you know, our dreams, our strategies, whatever. You know, one thing I left out before, Norman, was how do you account for suddenly this reform commission surfacing, making recommendations to reform and moderate the practices of the NSA? Obviously, there's a publicity and aspect to it, but isn't the Obama administration and Obama himself a little worried about his falling ratings, the fact that he's being associated with, you know, instead of change, you know, kind of repression?
Yeah, well, I think this has been a cumulative problem for him, which he brought on himself. When you appoint someone like Timothy Geithner to be Treasury Secretary, when you bring in people like Richard Holbrooke and Hillary Clinton to help run your foreign policy, when you essentially, rhetoric aside, align yourself with Wall Street and the status quo when so many people are hurting financially, then you have left the only populist avenue largely open to the right wing. I mean, I think you could make a case that Obama's first year in office helped to incubate the strength of the Tea Party, because Obama was dead set against progressive populism. He didn't represent it in his first year or two, or for that matter at all, in his administration. And it's been a disaster.
Well, let's try to understand why. Why do you think? Because, I mean, there are people who are saying, you know, to me, you know, Danny, the NSA probably has some stuff on Obama, hence he has to support them. You know, I mean, maybe that's simplistic. But what do you, is it, I mean, obviously he's cautious. Obviously he's conservative in many of his values. He's very hesitant to take any stand except a very highly symbolic one, visible one. The other hand, he'll go to South Africa and actually say some very progressive things about Nelson Mandela and talk about him as a guerrilla leader, you know, and stuff that we should know about. You know, in other words, is he a contradiction, or is there, do you have a bead on him that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I think his rhetoric, as in 2008, is much better than his reality. And he essentially passed what we call the money primary and the corporate media primary to get into the White House in the first place. You know, my flippant answer, which is only partly in jest, is that I do political analysis and media analysis, not psychoanalysis. So I don't really know the innards of his brain. But I do know, for instance, that it is an important indicator when we look at who is now Secretary of Commerce, who he appointed about a year ago, Penny Pritzker. She was his finance chair for his initial campaign for president. She is a billionaire with a B. She comes out of, as I recall, the Hyatt family. And she and her family made a killing financially with these high-risk mortgages off of African-American and Latinos who subsequently lost their homes. And she took up Obama's presidential campaign a half dozen years ago and helped make it a success. You know, that's an indicator. He aligned himself with the wealthy, and his policies, for the most part, have been a sort of a corporate centrist. He's not far right, but on the other hand, it is President Obama who put on the table openly cuts in Social Security and Medicare benefits.
But I think, you know,
that alone is unconscionable.
I think what you just said there, it's President Obama. And I think when you're a politician, you know, you become president, and then suddenly you start looking at the world a little bit differently. So, you know, if he goes against the NSA and then, you know, some terrorist attack on his watch, you know, there he goes in the history books. He's the guy, you know, that allowed Americans to be killed, blah, blah, blah.
Wait a second. I really want to talk about this with you a little bit more, Norman, also in light of your own experience as somebody who ran for office and, the challenges you had in raising money and maintaining, you know, a visible, you know, campaign. You were very close. You were in, you know, just a handful of votes, and you probably could get elected, but you know the dynamics of these elections and the role money plays. Could you hang with us for a little bit more,
sure,
and keep in this conversation, because it's getting good now, finally. And we're going to go to our next song, and then we're going to take a break, and we're going to come right back here on PRN-FM, News Dissector Radio Hour.
First thing when I wake up, right before I close my eyes at night, I think, sense, feel, man, like I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars.
talking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this?
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning, Saturday stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buying Coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door. And that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Kindness, right? And ratings pressures.
News goo.
What we need to know.
News goo.
What we want to know.
We got news goo.
What we think we know.
Yeah, that was the infamous Polarity one, News Goo.
And it was a song based on my first book for Seven Stories Press, The More You Watch, The Less You Know. And this was kind of a musical version of the book. My new book for Seven Stories Press out now is called Madiba A to Z, The Many Faces of Nelson Mandela. And I've been speaking about that in the media. Today I was at the General Assembly at the United Nations, actually invited there, Norman, as a special guest, where the nations of the world who were at this meeting, each of them made, statements about why Nelson Mandela meant something to them. It was really interesting that people from Jamaica spoke about how Jamaican artists like Peter Tosh and Bob Marley were responsible for galvanizing anti-war and anti-apartheid activism. Others, the representative from Bolivia, spoke of Mandela as a socialist. He was the only one to make that claim. There was a Cuban speaker there who talked about, the alliance between South Africa's ANC and Cuba and fighting in Angola against the South African army. It was fascinating to see how in our media, when there was this memorial for Nelson Mandela in South Africa, the big story was Barack Obama. That's what Americans saw. And then they saw him taking a picture of himself. Then they heard about this interpreter who wasn't interpreting and booing of the South African president and any distraction that could possibly be found. But what the rest of the world was saying and how Mandela, Madiba as he's known, became a global icon was missing in the media. And of course, his real history, including the fact that the CIA, which brings us back to what we started talking about here, was responsible for tipping off the South African police, who actually arrested him based on a tip from the CIA and or British intelligence. This is also something that's been whitewashed out of a lot of the history books and barely mentioned or rarely mentioned in our media, if mentioned at all. Any thoughts?
Yes, I should mention here that the group that I work with, one of the groups, RootsAction.org, launched a petition about a week ago urging that the U.S. government release all of the documents about the CIA complicity and role in the original capture of Nelson Mandela way back in the early 1960s. And if people want to find and sign that petition, which I think has gathered about 20,000 signers, you can go to RootsAction.org.
I mean, we've also discovered, and I talk about this in my book, Madiba A to Z, that Mandela was kept on the U.S. terrorism list until 2008, when it was, it was such an, he was elected in 1994, okay? He left office in, 1999. And here was 2008. He was still considered a terrorist by the U.S. government. John Kerry and a few other members of Congress, finally moved to get him off the list. But just about 6 weeks ago here in New York, one of his comrades in the Robben Island prison, a former guerrilla fighter turned major industrialist, no less, Tokio Sexuali, was stopped at JFK Airport and was refused admission into the United States because he's on this list. So the penetration of you know, kind of police state practices in the United States is very pervasive, also very inaccurate, based on informant testimony or crazy assumptions about organizations and the like. And so a man who the whole world admired and reveres, basically, if today's General Assembly, you know, tribute to him was any indication of how many countries got up and praised him today, it's a sign of how out of touch the United States government is with the world. And Americans, unfortunately, are also out of touch because our media doesn't report on all this and doesn't tell us about it. And this is something that's very disturbing. I mean, tell us a little bit about your experience in running for office and getting media coverage or not.
Well, you know, like you, Danny, I have had some experiences on both ends of the media operations, having worked inside media and then as an activist, as, if you will, a media observer, or even perish the phrase consumer, and to see from different vantage points the way in which news is covered or not covered and how it's spun certainly also applies to the political arena, including people running for office. And so, of course, as a campaign volunteer and as an activist and protester and writer and speaker and reader, watcher, listener of news, I'd been engaged in some ways in the subject of elections for decades. And then I, 2 years ago, became a candidate. And so one of the things that I knew was going to be in place but was still stunning was the absence of serious coverage of a congressional race. You know, our district goes from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border. It's the second congressional district of California. I ran as a declared candidate for 18 months, and it was very rare that any newspaper within the district or circulating in the district would write anything about any issues involved in the campaign or any differences or distinctions or positions that candidates were taking.
But and you also attracted, though, some outside support from a very well-known media maven. Phil Donahue came out to the district and actually campaigned with you. What kind of response did he get, and did you get in his presence? That, you know, in other words, you know, there's such, even with Mandela, you know, Mandela has been given the full Madonna treatment, you know, celebrity, so much so that, you know, it was embarrassing to him because everybody was saying, well, he was the savior of South Africa. And he said, no, I wasn't. I was part of a movement, a social movement, and I believe in collective leadership, and I wasn't. But it didn't seem to matter to a lot of the media. Yeah. You know, there was Mandela, and that was about the only other, and one other name, Bishop Tutu, ever got into the press, and nobody knew anything else about the ANC or what they were for or what their history is or anything else. I mean, it was pretty shocking to me that you have a figure who, you know, literally is transcendent in terms of media attention, almost the second best known brand in the world. Okay. He's a name that everybody knows, responds to in some way. Okay. And yet the coverage and the writing about him and the history story articles about him was so thin. The New York Times, I think it's today, has a correction. You know, Nelson Mandela did not start the ANC in 1942. We're sorry. The ANC was actually started in 1912. Okay. Excuse me. You know, like in the early part of the century, the same year that the NAACP was started. That's how ignorant. This is one of the leading newspapers in America. So here you are out there in the second district in California with Phil Donahue, and you're speaking, you're on a campaign stop. What was it like?
Well, because Phil Donahue was so generous with his time, we're able to spend 4 days together going from Marin County near the Golden Gate Bridge all the way up to Eureka and Arcata up in Humboldt County. And each night we would stop and show this wonderful film that and very upsetting film that he produced, and that is the film called Body of War. So we showed it four different nights up and down the coast and drew good crowds into the hundreds and hundreds each time. And Phil spoke and I spoke, and it was a chance to inject some very sobering, important issues and discourse into the campaign. So it was very helpful, and certainly the fact that I ended up falling short of getting through the primary by 0.1%, if
amazing,
it weren't for
amazing.
Phil Donahue's willingness and generosity of his time, then I think it would have been a wider gap, no doubt.
Didn't Sean Penn also support your candidacy?
He did. He used to live in Marin County. He moved to Southern California, back to Southern California, several years ago. But he made a trip back to the North Bay here and campaigned with me and spoke at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma, California.
You know,
so he was, you know, we know each other from having gone to Iraq in 2002 together before the invasion in an attempt to initiate or further dialogue between Americans and Iraqis as an alternative to war. And he was, of course, quite courageous to do that. The drums were beating in December 2002. The New York Post was calling him Baghdad Sean for sticking his neck out. And, of course, history has shown that he was brave and visionary and unfortunately not heeded by the powers that be.
And also very principled, as we saw in Haiti, where he was somebody who didn't just go, you know, for a photo op, but stuck around and really tried to help there in a very, you know, horrific situation. So I have a lot of respect.
Yes.
I certainly have a lot of respect for him and for you, Norman. And I wanted to, you know, bring you back on to talk about this. You know, we're coming to the end of the year, and, of course, there's a ritual in all the news organizations. And I was talking about this with Polar here in the studio a few moments ago. You know, what do you think the top stories of this year have been? What you know, what changed in 2013, or what hasn't changed? How do you, what's your take on how to talk about this? I'll have a few thoughts on it, but I'd really love to get your take.
Well, thanks to the whistleblower Edward Snowden and journalists, primarily Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, willing to stick their necks out, I think there has been a tremendous change in the understanding, the knowledge, and the willingness to push back against the surveillance state. And with due respect to Time Magazine, I do think that that is the overarching, if one has to choose one, shift that should be acknowledged. But credit to the new Pope, who is the so-called man and person of the year at Time Magazine. If the trend continues, his openness to at least a less misogynist church and toward liberation theology, I think that's all to the good. Domestically, one other thing I'd mention that comes to mind, Danny, is the threat to Social Security, which is not over. And the way in which this White House, as we were talking about briefly earlier, put Medicare benefits and Social Security benefits on the table, and that progressives rose up and fought back. And I think this battle is going to continue to rage, but it's at least provisionally encouraging to me that we've really made some headway.
You know, isn't their argument, though, it's never a straightforward admission of what they're actually doing, the compromises that they're making, but they're saying we have to be realistic, Norman. We have to be realistic. You keep hearing that, you know, you are, you know, it's well good for you to blah, 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 but we are running, you know, we are in power. We are la, 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 la. How do you cope with that? How do you respond to that?
Well, yes, and we touched on this earlier in terms of, okay, now he's president. He doesn't want to be blamed for this or that. It's all about priorities. And even before Obama was president, during the 2008 campaign in the Senate, he shafted progressives. And I was an Obama delegate at that point. I was mortified. I was a delegate to the National Convention. In the summer of 2008, he voted to give immunity to the telecoms for violating our civil liberties, after exposure in 2005, belatedly by the New York Times, that we were being wiretapped illegally, domestic surveillance. And these are moral choices. There's always excuses that are being given. Lyndon Johnson didn't want to be blamed for, quote-unquote, losing, that's the terminology, Vietnam. And so we had 58,000 Americans and 2 to 3 million Vietnamese people killed on the excuse that, well, he's president now, he has to be a grown-up. I think that's just wrong, and we need to challenge that approach. We need moral leadership. And, you know, in a domestic sense, there's the famous comment from Lyndon Johnson, a positive sense. He pushed for civil rights legislation and said, we, the Democratic Party, are going to lose the South for generation. And he was certainly right. He might have said 2 or 3 generations, but that's why social change requires moral leadership.
And I think it also, Polar, do you want to weigh in here?
Well, yeah, actually, something that I wanted to bring up, you know, one of the big stories of the year, and it also ties in with something I wanted to say about what we were discussing before about the media's take on Mandela, is the Obamacare website that's generated such a ridiculous amount of press and seems to be altering people's opinions of the health care plan. You know, this is about Americans, you know, the alpha dogs of planet Earth, being inconvenienced, and how we just can't bear to be inconvenienced. And really, I think this is at the heart of a lot of the problems we have. It's not just the corporate media. You know, if you give Americans a choice to actually get information that doesn't have a dramatic soundtrack under it, they know where to go. I mean, you know, if nothing else, for Christ's sake, you turn on PBS to get the news and see a bunch of, you know, crusty old people saying, and now, da, 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 and there's just nothing sexy going on, but there's actually information. There are ways that American citizens can do things, except that we all want to be entertained all the time. And we don't really care to sit and hear a lot of backstory on Mandela and the ANC because we want a simple story. We want a simple narrative. We're busy. We're hungry. We want whatever it is we want to get back to, you know, the football game or whatever, or, you know, a rally about yet another issue. You know, we won't sit and listen to
I mean, one of the interesting aspects of this that comes to mind, Norman, I don't know if you saw this, but I've done 6 films with Mandela, so I've traveled with him in many different places. Mm-hmm. And one event I traveled with him to was the Congressional Gold Medal ceremony in the Congress. And what was striking about it was all of these right wingers who couldn't get, you know, had to have their picture taken with him, but just couldn't stay away. You know, Senator, what's his name, from South Carolina, who was the segregationist.
Oh, Lindsey Graham?
Yeah, no, the original now in segregation.
Strom Thurmond?
Yeah, Strom Thurmond was there, loving Nelson Mandela.
What a racist.
And so was Newt Gingrich, okay? So Gingrich had, you know, was a high school history teacher or something, on a junior college somewhere. He apparently graduated from some school somewhere. And, you know, he gets attacked when he, you know, he expressed a moment of remorse that Mandela had died, okay? And a couple of these blowhearts in the Tea Party or wherever attack him, okay, for, you know, supporting a terrorist or something like that. And
yes, it was an unconscionable lapse of racism racism.
Right. And Gingrich went nuts. I mean, Gingrich, you could challenge me on this. You know, it was like this was beyond his capacity to understand. And he said, I thought you people are big, you know, revolutionaries. You stand up for the American Revolution. What do you think these guys were doing? They were having their own American Revolution. You know, so it was so interesting, the depths of, you know, how corrupted our discourse is, that you can't even talk yeah. about something that requires an ounce of intelligence or background without it being reduced to some sort of stereotype. I think you're also right, you know, Polar. The problem with indicting the people, is that's who we ultimately have to convince and work with and find ways to talk with. And you can't abolish. Who is it that said you can't abolish the people? You know, the people are.
Yeah, it's I think Bertolt Brecht said people in East Germany were rioting against high food prices, and the government of East Germany was denouncing the people rioting. And Brecht said, well, if the government doesn't like the people, it can elect some new ones.
There you go. Well, listen, how do people hook up with Roots Action? Because, you're doing some great stuff, and people should know, more people should know about it. Let me put it that way. So how do you do that?
Yes, our latest petition now is for the Washington Post to acknowledge in its coverage of the CIA this huge conflict of interest with its owner now, the Jeff Bezos. And people can go to our website at rootsaction.org. That's R-O-O-T-S action.org. You can sign up to get our action updates. You can participate in messaging to your members of Congress. And it's great to grow. You know, we have 400,000 active members. We started at zero, and it's because of our politics. We just want to challenge the corporate warfare state, and it's good to be part of our movements that are doing that.
Let me make a little suggestion to you, if I may, okay?
Sure.
The spirit of giving, the spirit of the season, we're doing a pretty cool radio show here on Progressive Radio Network. It's one of the better-kept secrets of American broadcasting. But if we could somehow hook up with what you're doing, I think more people would find it, and we could help attract more people to it with programs like the one tonight, where we have had, I think, a really intelligent, fun, and informative discussion about some of the core issues that we all need to know about. Thank you again, Norman Solomon, for being with us tonight, being willing to stick around for a little more time to be on the show, and I really appreciate it. And so does, I believe, Polar. Is that true?
Yes, there's an element of truth there.
Okay,
hey,
there you go.
I've been an admirer of you, the News Dissector, for literally more than 40 years. And,
oh, my God.
Keep up the great work.
Okay, well, thank you. You didn't have to give away my age. Anyway, thank you very much, Norman. If folks want to get in touch with me, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. I'm editing and working on the Media Channel. We're back in action online. Check us out, mediachannel.org, for some of the best writing on media issues. I also do a daily blog at newsdissector.net. which you can check out. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on wherever I can be on. Right now our website for my book is MedibaBook.com. That's MedibaBook.com. So thanks for being with us. Thank you, Heather, for being at the controls for one more week, doing a great job here at PRN. Happy holidays, one and all. And we're going to go out with a carefully selected musical statement.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price.